Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nonprofit View, a forum where nonprofit stakeholders can share lessons learned and discuss the latest developments in the industry. My name is Valerie Leonard, your host. I'm a consultant to nonprofits, and I specialize in community and organizational development. I work with nonprofit organizations to help them make a stronger impact to their clients and communities, and you can find Nonprofit View on Facebook and Twitter. I encourage you to comment early and often using the hashtags NonprofitView, HSI, or Do the Right Thing. And when we say Do the Right Thing, that's Do as in Donald Do, D-E-W. You can also comment on blogtalkradio.com, NonprofitView, and the chat room is open. You can post comments and questions. In order to use the chat room, you have to have a listener-only account, then you'll find a link to open the account on the episode page. You can also email me questions at consulting@valeriefleonard.com or send messages through Facebook and Twitter. You'll find a Nonprofit View fan page on Facebook, and the Twitter account is @NonprofitView. We'll be taking questions by phone and from my chat room at about the 20-minute mark. The call-in number is 347-884-8121. Today's episode is Do the Right Thing, a discussion on mental health services, people with disabilities, and the state budget. We'll talk about HSI's programs and services, discuss the impact of the Illinois budget crisis on social service agencies, and share ways nonprofit leaders can advocate on behalf of the least of these. Again, we encourage you to call in with questions and participate in live chats at about the 20-minute mark. The call-in number is 347-8121. Nonprofit professionals, educators, and community stakeholders are especially encouraged to call in and share your stories. Our guest for today is Donald J. Dew. Donald is the CEO of Habilitative Systems, Inc., or HSI. In June 1990, Donald Dew was selected from a field of over 150 candidates to fill the position of president and CEO of HSI. HSI is a vital Chicago-based health and human services organization, and they currently operate over 40 programs for thousands of children and families in need. Under Donald's tenure, HSI's budget has grown to approximately $7.5 million, and that's pretty good for an organization that started in the basement of a church. He has been at the helm of HSI during good times and challenging times, and he's reinvented himself and the organization all along the way. A very small sampling of Donald's many accomplishments include the employment of workers with disabilities, and they've assembled 8,000 collector telephones for the 1996 Democratic National Convention. They've also developed the Ameritech HSI Bill Payment Center. They've secured over $20 million in the past decade from HUD and the Chicago Department of Housing, where they developed 160 units of housing for seniors and for people with disabilities. They've also acquired the Service Master franchise to employ people with disabilities and developed the HSI Research Institute and many other organizational and strategic initiatives. Donald has a Master of Social Work, or MSW, from Jane Addams College of Social Work at the University of Illinois, as well as a BA in Social Work from Lewis University, where he currently serves as adjunct faculty in organizational leadership within the College of Arts and Sciences. So you can find a bio for Donald on my blog, Nonprofit View, under Episode 16, Do the Right Thing. Again, Do is spelled D-E-W. Go to valeriefleonard.com/nonprofitview and click on to the episodes page. So thanks for being on the show, Donald. It's indeed an honor to have you. I didn't do justice to your resume. You've got lots and lots of accomplishments, and we're very grateful to have you on the West Side. Can you tell us how
it's truly my pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you, thank you. Can you tell us how you came to get involved in social work, and what led you to HSI specifically?
Well, once again, thank you so much. It's a true opportunity and privilege for me to be on your show, Valerie. I think this is an innovative and very timely concept that you've got. And, again, many thanks to you for working with not-for-profits and working with them in such a strategic manner as you're doing. Several years ago, many years ago, just watching, you know, my mother, you know, work as a community organizer, helping to be one of the organizers of the Miles Square Health Center, working with colleagues of hers like Ms. Earlene Lindsay and many others back in those days, folks like Dan Cantrell and Danny Davis in the early days of Miles Square, folks like Reginald Hatch Adams over at Rush University Medical Center. Watching all of those folks do the work that they were doing in the early 70s is really was very impressive to me, and really prompted me to go into social work and want to embrace that as a career.
Oh, that is great, and you learn from the best, I can tell you. So
yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say, and you know, just having had colleagues there, having worked at Miles Square and places like Community Mental Health Council with Dr. Carl Bell, one day I got a phone call from another colleague of mine by the name of Rick Tanksley. And Rick is currently the chief over at the Oak Park Police Department. And he basically said, hey, Don, I'm about to leave a position that I'm working over here at HSI, and this one might work for you. And that was back in 1984, and Rick was serving as a case coordinator for a program that was called the Title 19 Medicaid Waiver, which was designed to assist persons with developmental disabilities to benefit from community living. And I came over and talked with a young lady by the name of Dr. Cynthia Tate, who was the associate executive director at the time at Humbilitative Systems, and she gave me the job to be the director of case coordination. And that happened in 1984, and I've been here ever since.
Well, I haven't looked back. Okay, so under your leadership, HSI has become the first, or they were the first, African-American-led community-based organization to receive CARF accreditation. So can you tell us what that is, and then give us a sense of what that means to consumers and their families?
Well, CARF stands for the Commission on Accreditation of Rehabilitation Facilities, and CARF is, as a primary charge, is focused on quality, focused on results. When a provider goes after CARF accreditation, basically it's a primary signal that that service provider is committed to continuously improving their services and encouraging feedback from the major stakeholders and primarily serving the community. It's interesting the way that we became CARF accredited, because back in 1990, unfortunately, we lost our predecessor, Larry T. Byrd. Larry had been the executive director at HSI from his founding in 1978 through 89, when unfortunately he had a very untimely passing. So in 1990, we were faced with this executive transition. And one of the things that I thought about at that time was to seek out CARF accreditation, because they have various standards that are set up, you know, as I stated previously, to focus on quality. And it's a qualitative tool for continuous improvement. So I said, in this, you know, time of executive transition, why not use nationally established standards and quality care methods to help guide the agency through a very difficult time? So the first time out, we were able to achieve a one-year accreditation back in 1991, and have been accredited ever since.
Wow. The first time out. That's great. So that's a testament to your leadership. You have always been a very strong leader.
Well, I'll tell you, Valerie, it's leadership, but it's also a team. Nobody can do it by themselves. And, you know, I've been blessed to have had wonderful mentors and team members every step of the way. And that really makes a difference.
Okay, awesome. And I see where we have a caller, but I wanted to get through, you know, some more questions, and then we will, you know, take a call from this caller. All righty. HSI operates a number of behavioral health programs along a broad continuum, and that ranges from alcoholism and substance abuse treatment to things like the community release program. So we're looking at a very broad and intense, I think, continuum. Can you share brief highlights from three of your mental health programs? And specifically, we're looking for an overview and why these programs are important and some of your achievements.
Thank you. One of the programs I'd like to highlight is our residential program for persons who have been challenged by mental illness. As we know, there's situation after situation that we see that is a reflection of persons who are really in need of treatment for mental illness as opposed to incarceration. And what we provide in our residential programs, and we've got about four different residential components that we operate for persons with mental illness, it's significant that many of the persons who occupy those sites were formerly in Cook County Jail. We've heard mm-hmm. Sheriff Dart talk about the fact that, you know, the Cook County Jail system is like the largest provider of mental health services in the country at this time. And we realized that by having that resource, a place to stay, makes all the difference in the world. He said, you know, when he's talking to folks who are detained there, they'll say in a heartbeat that one of the main reasons why they're there is that they don't have a place to live. They don't have a place to work. They don't have a way to sustain themselves. So, you know, what we're saying once over and over again is that if we can provide folk an opportunity to get support, have a nurturing environment, that they can make a difference and we can impact upon that rate of return, or what we call recidivism, to county jails and state institutional facilities. Another program is the Urban Behavioral Health Services Institute, or UBHSI. That program is located primarily in Inglewood at 6845 Southwestern. We opened up that program primarily as an opportunity for us to expand our services into the Inglewood community, a major, major area where, again, persons who were formerly incarcerated or being detained were coming back to. We found through research that many persons who were incarcerated were coming to the West Side, North Lawndale in particular, and also to Inglewood. So it made sense for us to, you know, try and provide supports to persons who, again, would require that service there. We called it the Urban Behavioral Health Services Institute because we really wanted to talk about best practices. We wanted to do what was in the best interest of the person served, and we wanted to be in a position to have academic support for these efforts, for these treatment efforts. And that's one of the reasons why we've affiliated with over 15 different colleges and universities, so that from the research and academic support side, you know, we could get interns in, you know, we could, you know, participate in research studies and certainly talk about evidence-based practices. And then the third program I would just highlight is the CNA case management program, which is child and adolescent case management. You know, too many of our children and adolescents out here are experiencing violence, being subjected to domestic violence as well, violence from bullying, violence from gangs, victimized by drugs, you name it. So many of our kids and adolescents are experiencing very real post-traumatic stress and continuous stress. You know, there's the anticipation of violent episodes. All this creates just an alarming an imbalance, if you will, state of mind. And there's no wonder that, you know, our kids are being challenged and are in and out of juvenile detention and in and out of hospitals and are going through a number of challenges in terms of their academic performance or social behaviors. I mean, there's a lot going on in their communities and in our communities, and it's a very difficult challenge for kids to be able to navigate that. So we provide them with, you know, intensive case management, you know, treatment, mentoring, tutorial services, provide support to the families, ensure that basically, you know, our children are getting the kind of support that they need to be able to get through these challenging times. So that's just three of the many programs that we operate for the mentally ill.
That's 3 out of 40.
Well, we stay busy over here, Valerie, that's for sure. Never a question about what we're doing with our money. We're out here really trying to serve folk and make a difference.
I'm telling you, we're going to have you back again so you can go over each of those programs at some point. I realize I could take a series of programs, but, you know, you've done some really interesting work.
Thank you.
Okay, so in 1970. Yeah, in 1978, HSI became the first African-American agency to operate a sheltered workshop for people with developmental disabilities on Chicago's West Side. since that time, you've served thousands of clients with disabilities, and I'm wondering if you can tell us about some of your programs for folks with disabilities and the impact to clients and their families and taxpayers. And I know you touched on some of that, but I guess this time around, if you can share with us, too, the impact to the taxpayers.
Absolutely. You know, 2015 marks the 25th anniversary of the American with Disabilities Act. That was signed into law back in June of 1990. And, you know, since that time, it's really been about full participation and integration of persons with disabilities, physical disabilities, developmental disabilities, you name it. It's all about full participation and integration and equal opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people with disabilities, just like African Americans, have been historically discriminated against, just like women have been historically discriminated against. So one of the things that we found with the passing of that act was that this would open up the doors for real access, you know, to break down attitudinal barriers, physical barriers, employment barriers. Anyone receiving any type of public support basically needed to abide by the mandates of that American with Disabilities Act.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, ever since we've been in business, HSI has been serving people with disabilities. Our sheltered workshop for persons with disabilities, residential programs that we've operated, we built five facilities, community integrated living arrangements that serve persons with developmental disabilities. We've had a number of different contracts for persons to learn through simulated work. We used to manufacture pillows for airlines and Amtrak passenger lines. Those are disposable pillows. Currently, we're doing packaging and sorting and assembly and work like that, and giving folks an opportunity to really potentially get back into the workforce. So we do
mm-hmm.
supported employment for these persons and provide them with competitive employment opportunities. But the primary focus at this time is on work and training and opening up the door for us to have what we call a unrestricted source of income. If we can do a better job at these contracts, that can be another source of revenue for us.
Oh, that's great. We do have two callers. I do want to get to them, but I have a couple more questions I need to ask of you, Donald, and then we'll open it up to callers. So if there's anyone else other than these two callers that might have a question, feel free to call in at 347-884-8121. We want to go through a couple questions with Donald Dew, CEO of HSI, first, and then we will get to your questions and comments. So I want to thank you again, Donald Dew. This is a really interesting discussion. I heard you say that you developed over 160 units of housing for seniors and people with disabilities, and people might look at what you do and wonder, why in the world would you get into the housing business? You know, here you are, an MSW, and you're doing housing. So what made you go into the housing business?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I would observe and had observed for a number of different years that we've been working with persons and trying to rebuild lives and then looking at all the housing that was being rehabbed on the west side of Chicago. And I said, you know, it's about, you know, rehabbing buildings, but it's also, you know, rehabbing lives and giving folks a new opportunity to rebuild their lives. And symbolically, I just wanted to be a part of creating an environment, a campus, if you will, that was promoting basically normalcy and growth, giving folk an opportunity to, you know, rise above their life circumstances and be able to do so in an environment that was, you know, a little bit more safe, a little bit more secure, one that they would be, again, nurtured and supported in. There were opportunities also from the business side because as we were running many residential programs, we were leasing a lot of these programs. So it just didn't make a lot of sense for us on a regular basis to continue to lease programs when we were in a position to also, you know, get funding to actually do new construction. So, you
mm-hmm.
know, from a human sense in terms of human development and potential and from a business sense, we thought that it made sense for us to get into housing. And last but not least, you know, I was around when the riots occurred, you know, after Martin Luther King's assassination, and we saw what happened to the West Side, and we saw how many vacant lots were created, you know, by the, you know, community just going up in smoke. And I really wanted to be a part of rebuilding the West Side of Chicago.
Yes, yes, yes. Full disclosure, I still live in the community that he's talking about. We have not recovered. That was back in 1968, and we still have over 1,500 vacant lots. So the funding environment is totally different from what it was when you started working with HSI back in 1984. When you started working with HSI, service delivery standards were high, and they remain high. But in the 80s, the state seemed to be very eager to partner with community-based organizations, and the funding was not quite as tight as it is today. In fact, the last time you and I were together at length, you were on a panel to discuss some of the impacts of the Illinois budget cuts on the Illinois Department of Human Services, and ultimately this impacts agencies and the community. So can you share with us an update?
Absolutely. You know, back in the 80s, when I started, we were basically on grant-based funding. We moved from grants into fee-for-service and performance-based contracting, and now we're into something called Medicaid Managed Care. But the bottom line of all of that is that, you know, the regulatory environment has increased and become even more intense. So that means that, you know, as you're working with different special populations, be it people with disabilities, people with mental illness, people who are challenged by substance abuse, et cetera, you have to deal with all the regulatory mandates associated with those particular targeted populations. So as a result, you know, we are finding that, you know, we have to continue to compete and continue to experience the raising of the bar. And literally, in terms of being able to serve the community, it's a lot more challenging for you to just be able to do basic good in your neighborhood without all the associated challenges of the regulatory mandates. Now, they're good. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it's good because it's always, you know, and I like to think it's based on quality and trying to make sure that people are safe and getting the best services possible. But the reality of the situation is that the cost of doing business is increasing, and there's not a whole lot of support coming from our funding sources to do that. The update on the budget is that we still have no state budget. We as an agency have received, you know, a few dollars for our disability services, some dollars for our alcohol and substance abuse services, but we have not received the dollars through our grant for mental health services. We received some dollars through Medicaid, and we've been receiving some dollars through our partnerships and affiliations with managed care organizations. But there's another chunk of our dollars, our revenue, that we're contracted to receive from the state that we've not received since July 1. So, you know, it's had a tremendous impact. I mean, you know, cash flow is not flowing as it should. We experience delays in payroll. We experience bills and vendors having to wait to be paid. And, you know, it's unfortunate that hardship is being created, you know, by this situation. And those who are seeking to serve those in hardship are, in fact, being placed in hardship. So it's a very challenging situation when many of us are just trying to serve our community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I thank you for sharing, you know, your story with your agency. And you have definitely made a huge impact on communities like North Lawndale, where I live, Inglewood, and the like. And the interesting thing is the state of Illinois is going through one of the roughest times in history, not because of lack of money. You know, we're really in an economic recovery, and typically over $28 billion is set aside to, you know, to fund nonprofit agencies. And the state has been operating without a budget for more than 3 months just because, you know, the governor and the legislative leaders can't come to an agreement. And, you know, like you said, you know, some agencies are really in a bind, you know, including yours. Some have even had to close their doors. So I guess with that said, what are some of the strategies that you've heard some of your colleagues use, you know, to try to get through this crisis?
Well, you know, I think there are, you know, certainly opportunities wherever there's a threat. And I think that there's a tremendous opportunity for collaboration. I think there's a tremendous opportunity for us to look at partnerships. And clearly those partnerships and opportunities lie with healthcare agencies, various MCOs, federally qualified health centers. Basically, we need to look at an integrated health delivery approach. Other opportunities are going to manifest more so in terms of business and industry, in terms of employment and training. You've heard referenced earlier the franchise that we have been affiliated with. We're not doing that right now, but you know, clearly we could reenter that market should the conditions become a little bit more palatable for that to occur.
Mm-hmm.
But like any small business, and I always say that, you know, beyond social services, you know, we're also and should be considered as a small business, because when you're employing
mm-hmm.
people, when you're doing housing, when you're providing opportunities for tradesmen to work in the community and benefit from your presence, that's small business, you know, and that's economic
mm-hmm.
and local, significant local economic impact.
And great. So one more question before we open it up for our callers. Can you share three lessons that you've learned in your nonprofit management experience over the years?
Well, you know, there's just been countless lessons, but so just say three. I would say as a first point, as a first point, keep your focus. You know, keep your focus on service and being true to your mission. Don't be, you know, dollar driven. Be service driven. Focus on what's in the best interest of the people that you're trying to serve. So you got to keep that focus. If you don't keep that focus, then you're gonna you'll be depressed. You'll be burnt out. You know, and just totally feeling apathetic about any possibility for change in the community. So that's number one. Number two. We got to continually think strategically, not panic, feel that all hope is lost, but to continue to think strategically about where the opportunities exist, and you give yourself a fighting chance that way. And last but not least, there's got to be a constant focus on diversifying the revenue base. If there's anything that I probably wish I would have done more of in the early years is to have started the contractual side of HSI and the franchise side of HSI a little bit earlier. You know, some of our agencies have abandoned the old traditional social services and actually moved out of social services into healthcare and become federally qualified health centers. Others have become just housing entities and done a lot of affordable housing. Some have just totally decreased and eliminated their dependence on government dollars and become self-sustaining through some of these business opportunities. So those are some of the major lessons that I've gotten over the last 31 years that I've been here.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So I'm going to open this up to callers. I recognize one phone number, and I think you'll really, really enjoy hearing from this guy. Just a moment. Hi, Dennis.
Yes, I am here.
Good afternoon, Dr. Beer. How are you, sir?
Afternoon, my brother. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
Wonderful, wonderful. So thanks for certainly sharing your wonderful experience and the opportunity that this journey has afforded you. I loved hearing about your array of services, and as you know, we're in the same field. But one question that I wanted to pose to you, given the economic climate and the climate that's here in the city of Chicago, what do you think, and I'll ask this question and then check off and listen to your response, what do you think is the solution to the multifactorial issue of violence here in Chicago?
Thank you for that question, Dr. Deer. And again, let me also salute your work, young brother. It's encouraging for me to see, you know, our men, our women continue to come, you know, with intestinal fortitude to want to serve our community and continue to lift our community up. So it's always very encouraging to me to see the younger folk come on through and keep it going and pass the baton on. Violence.
Thank you for
putting the
trails for us.
Yes, sir. Violence. First of all, let me just say that in my mind and in my thinking, the violence that we see is a symptom of the pain that our community has been feeling and experiencing. And there's one solution to pain, and that is, you know, you got to find some comfort. You got to find something to ease that pain. You got to find some strategy to deal with the source and the cause of that pain and that suffering. So, you know, is it, you know, issues of one-parent families? Is it an issue of, you know, the conditions that, you know, our communities are experiencing? And is it related to poor schools and education and so on? It's all of that. It's all of that. But It really just comes back to one thing, and that is how can we ease the pain that people are experiencing? In some cases, it means being able to give a person a job so that they can take care of themselves and their families. In another case, and I'm talking about the social determinants of health, so part of that is economics, being able to work. Part of that is having a good place to live so that you don't have to be concerned about being homeless and on the street. Part of that is being able to feel good about yourself and your family and making sure that, you know, our children can have someone that they look up to. You know, there's still many heroes and sheroes in our community, and our children need to see them and feel them and touch them and be encouraged by them. So a lot of this violence is in my estimation, symptomatic of the pain that we've been experiencing. So our job, I think, as social engineers, is to engineer a way through the violence and find a way to create more opportunities for our folk, our community, to be comforted and to be healed, so that they can go ahead on and live more purposeful, beneficial, and worthwhile lives.
I like your answer. It's interesting to hear your response versus, you know, law enforcement and versus people who don't really have experience dealing directly with violence. You know, we tend to treat the symptoms, but, you know, nobody wants to touch the cause and the effects, you know, because that doesn't, you know, you can't heal that in election cycles.
No, you don't want to blame the victim. I mean, clearly, you know, there's got to be some personal responsibility for whatever goes on, but you don't want to just get into this mindset where you just constantly blame the victim and say that, you know, the person is responsible for their, you know, situation and condition in life. There are a lot of environmental factors that influence that behavior.
Okay, we have another caller. I want to see if this caller has any comments. I see a caller with the phone number 773-220-4070. Did you have any questions or comments?
No, I'm just an interested listener. Just happen to be listening to the conversation and enjoying it. Obviously, I agree with what much of Mr. Dew has said, in that I am on his staff. My name is Richard Jackson. I'm the VP of External Relations with HSI. So, you know, I always love hearing my boss, you know, present it the way that it is. And, you know, all kinds of stuff there.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson.
You're more than welcome, sir. I'll turn
Mr.
it back over.
Mr. Jackson. It's good to hear your voice.
Well, you too, and it's always a pleasure hearing your voice.
And I tell you, you guys make an awesome team.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate
that. Thank you, Valerie. Appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
He's out there always in the government sector, shaking that money tree and all that good stuff. So I think I cut him off. I hope he will forgive me. I didn't mean to cut him off completely. But are there any other callers? You can call in at area code 347-884-8121. And while we're waiting to see if there are any other callers, Donna, will you care to share any parting thoughts before we go?
Well, yes. I think that the solution to the state budget crisis is going to be a revenue solution. We have to continue to contain our costs. And as we generate more revenue, we have to be careful that we just don't engage in spending that's going to be out of control and put us back in the situation that we're currently in. But when you're looking at, you know, $5 to $9 billion deficit, when you look at the fact that a number of different major financial institutions have come up with, you know, recommendations that primarily are saying, yeah, we got to look at a combination of spending cuts and we have to look at revenue increases as a way of really helping us to get through this quagmire right now. It makes sense. The state comptroller, you know, talks about the fact that, we're spending about $36 million a year and revenue is only about $32 million a year. Clearly, we got to raise more revenue to support these vital services. The other thing I just want to really emphasize is that community-based treatment, community-based care is always more cost-effective and qualitative than state institutional or incarceration care. Again, By providing services at community-based level, we can save the state just millions of dollars and have been able to demonstrate that. And we have definitely been able to demonstrate that there can be, that there is and can be an experience of greater quality of life. I don't think folks want to be in an institution. I don't think folks want to be incarcerated. I think folks would prefer to be integrated in their communities, living healthy, safety lives, and safe lives. I don't think that to be locked up is the way to go. We've got to find the resources out here to be maintained in the community. And the last thing I want to say is that any policy that's promulgated at the federal, state, county, local level can only be implemented at the community-based level. It can be the American with Disabilities Act. It can be affordable care. But the bottom line is it always got to hit the ground. I mean, you always got to think about it can only be implemented at the community-based level. Somebody, some entity, some organization has got to be there to take that federal mandate, that state mandate, that local mandate, and make it real at the ground roots level, at the grassroots level.
Okay. And how can people reach you after the show?
Yes, I can be reached directly at the agency, 773-261-2252. Again, that's 773-261-2252.
So that's any nonprofit practitioner, that's anyone who might know someone who has issues with mental health or developmental disability, youth development, and the like. Is that correct?
Yes.
And senior housing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, after all, you have 40 programs. I can't remember them all. So what's your website so people can go and look at the 40 programs that you have?
Absolutely. That website is www.habilitative.org. That's H-A-B-I-L-I-T-A-T-I-V-E, habilitative.org. And, you know, we're looking to hire, you know, committed folk who want to serve our community. So if you're looking for a job in social services, this is the place to be. If you want to volunteer services, and, of course, if you want to make a donation, you can make a donation on our webpage as well. And we definitely need a donation.
Okay, awesome, awesome. So I want to thank you once again, Donald Dew, the CEO of Habilitative Systems, Inc. I want to thank our listeners for listening, and I thank you for your patience. We've had few technical difficulties, but I think we got through them, but I do thank you for your patience. The show will be available for download within about an hour, so be sure to tune in next week when we'll talk about nonprofit compliance, and I'm looking forward to a very lively discussion. So until next week, you take care, and thanks again.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Valerie. Truly appreciate it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Bye-bye. Bye.